Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I am Sandy Ingham, the consulting minister here, and some mornings I do the service, and some mornings someone from within our congregation does the service, and some mornings we have a speaker or presenter from outside of our congregation. If this is one of your first times here, three things, see if I can remember them all. We encourage you to come more than once because our services are different every Sunday. And we will have a place later on in the service, which you'll see in your program here, for introduction of guests and visitors. We try not to force you to do that, but if you'd like to do that, that would be good. Prairie tries to be open-hearted, open-minded. We welcome you, no matter what your color, your ethnicity, your sexual orientation, your gender, no matter where you are on the spiritual or religious journey. We welcome you. Towards the end of our socializing time, we'll have a very, very brief discussion, presentation of four issues that our General Assembly is going to consider which one to pick in June. So we'll have more about that later, but I urge you to stay. It's an informational meeting, and we will try to keep it very, very short. These, then, are the opening words. They were written by George de Benville, a Universalist minister. They were written sometime in the mid to late 1770s. Our Universalist faith is essentially the combined faith of all Christians. As no church is pure in all things, so none can be found that does not contain some truth. Glorious truths are found in every church and religion under the sun. And this glorious chain of truths, we believe, will someday unite all of them into one form of love. Please light the chalice. These words were written by Universalist Mary Livermore when she was 85 years old. That would have been at the very end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s. And she was a famous speaker during this time period that I'll be talking about in a minute. She writes, "False early conceptions darkened my childhood and youth." She's talking about her very Calvinist, very strict hellfire and damnation religious upbringing. "This faith in universalism during the years that I have believed it has grown upon me until it is the central thing in me. I do not engage in anything that is not, as I see it, the outcome of this faith. My later comprehension has given me a noble and abiding faith in human destiny. I am happy that I may still lend a hand to the weak and struggling, or strike a blow for the right against the wrong." The reading that I would like to share with you this morning is called Acquitted of Universalism, and it's by Unitarian Universalist minister Robert Walsh. In the newspaper, there was a story about a seminary professor in Kansas City who was put on trial by the Southern Baptists, accused of being a Universalist. It's no wonder they were suspicious. He had stated publicly his belief that all people born into the world are children of God. And as if that were not enough, he also supported the ordination of women. Case closed. The professor denied the charges. "I'm not a Universalist," he said. And he convinced them. After 4 hours of deliberation, they voted 21-11 to let him keep his job. "Now, I confess to being a Universalist," writes Walsh. "In fact, I am a Unitarian Universalist. But I wonder If I were arrested and charged with being one, would there be enough evidence to convict me? The Kansas City story proves that having the right beliefs is not enough. The professor believed that all people are brothers and sisters, that every person has a piece of the divine spark, that women are the equals of men in the sight of God. That was not enough to bring in a guilty verdict. No, if they are going to pin Unitarian Universalism on me, they will have to be able to show that I participated in and supported a Unitarian Universalist church. That is the only way to be sure. Beliefs, no matter how noble, must be embodied in a living institution, or they will have no convincing power. Today's service is made possible because of the lives of those Universalists who have gone before us, showing us a path, a way to bring more light into the world. But why do we bother to tell their stories? Well, several reasons. One, I told you in November, I told you a lot of stories towards the end of November, but the only stories I told you then were stories about Unitarians. I was talking then in late November about that great cloud of witnesses that surrounds us, and certainly Martin Luther King Jr. is one of those. Today it is the Universalist's turn. Of course, another reason is that we don't want to lose the knowledge of our Universalist past. As John Buren's wrote in the introduction to his book, A People's History, Universalists and Unitarians in America, our contemporary struggles to fulfill our promise as a religious movement and to do a better job of influencing the culture around us toward justice need a better understanding of struggles in the past. We have not always been realistic about our own powers. After all, as philosopher George Santayana, I'm not sure I say his name correctly because I don't use it in conversation very often, but you, I think most of you have heard of him. His mother happened to have been a Boston Unitarian, but as he once put it, and you're probably all familiar with this quote, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And then another reason to tell the stories of these Universalists. If you look at the quote at the top of your order of service, I am now lost. Oh, I have it right here. Martin Luther King Jr. told us, and by the way, I spoke last year for the entire time on this quote. It's a little known quote of Martin Luther King's. My friends, there are some things in our nation and in our world to which I'm proud to be maladjusted. And I call upon you to be maladjusted, and all people of goodwill to be maladjusted to these things until the good society is realized. So it is especially good to remember what King had to teach us on the weekend when we celebrate his birthday. Being maladjusted is something to be proud of. Knowing the stories about those from our tradition and heritage who were also maladjusted might just help us get out of bed in the morning and keep on keeping on. Universalists, said Lewis Fisher, then Dean of Rider Divinity School in Chicago, are often asked to tell where they stand. The only true answer is that we do not stand at all. We move. So let's start with some information about Benville, who's responsible for today's opening words, and who has been called the first preacher of Universalism in America. It is 1722 in northern France, and two young men have been arrested and charged with preaching heresy, heresy being any religious opinion not approved by the church and or the state. One penalty for this was death by hanging. And one of those two prisoners, 24-year-old George Durant, not our George, but another George, climbed up on the scaffold, sang a song, and supposedly joyfully died because he preferred death to life without religious liberty. But the other prisoner, our spiritual ancestor, George de Benville, had been given a slightly different punishment, beheading. Now, beheading was apparently a privilege during this time in France, but only available to those who were of noble birth, which he was. I don't know, hanging, beheading, beheading, hanging, I don't know. He got on the scaffold, this may be slightly urban legend, we don't know, but I've found the same story in several different sources. Had his hands tied together, refused an offer of a blindfold, knelt, had his head on the block, with that executioner right there with the axe, when up rode a man on horseback with a message from King Louis XV. It was a reprieve. Our George had connections in the royal family. De Benville was the youngest of nine children. His mother had twins four times in 4 years. Then she had George, and then she died.
Yeah.
But fortunately, though, for us, George survived his birth, and then he survived his beheading, and he eventually made it to America in 1741, after a few more imprisonments in France, and then some safer preaching in Holland and Germany. In this country, he became a physician, though he would continue to preach, and he was a missionary of sorts, I guess, if we could use that word. It was intriguing to me that de Benville spent a lot of time teaching and preaching in western Pennsylvania, which is where I grew up. But more intriguing to me was the fact that de Benville spent a lot of time practicing medicine and teaching in various Indian tribes. He became well known as a physician, and during the Battle of Germantown in the Revolutionary War, when he was 75, he helped the wounded from both the American and the British sides. We have to wonder what made de Benville so scary, at least in England and France, that they wanted to behead him. Why were the powers that be, both within the church and the crown, so afraid of this man, who believed that we are all equal in the sight of God? Well, I think we are still asking that question about our heroes. Why were people so afraid of Jesus? Why were people so afraid of Martin Luther King? We can do a whole service and more on this question. I think that what really makes these people that I'm talking about this morning and our other heroes really scary is that they were people of action. They put their beliefs into practice in their daily lives. Can't really be scary or threatening to anyone if we don't ever voice our beliefs to anyone else, let alone take them out into the real world and try to help others, try to make the world a fair, more just place. Universalism can be hard to define. You thought Unitarian was a tough one. When you get into the realm of universal love, universal small u, and a universal church that would encompass all beliefs, there's an element, a strong element, of mysticism. And there is an element of mysticism within universalism. And this can often does include the concept that we're part of the earth, hence our first hymn. Now, I don't have time this morning to really get into this, but I'll just leave you with one enticing tidbit. Spiritualism, with a capital S, enters the picture when we're trying to understand what the Universalists were doing in the early 1800s. But the important thing for this morning is to notice two parts of our Universalist background. The importance, as I've just said, of putting our beliefs into practice, making them mean something in the real world. And the second thing, how the Universalists were always expanding the definition of what it means to be human and who should be included in that circle of humanity. They were always making the circle wider. Another Universalist of this era, the Revolutionary War times, someone you've probably heard of, Benjamin Rush. He wrote the first official statement of Universalist beliefs, which I did not know that was written by Benjamin Rush. We know him, I think, largely because he signed the Declaration of Independence. He was opposed to slavery. He was concerned for the prisons. He was very much into prison reform. These people are all going to be way ahead of their times. He had a passion for peace, and he was involved in work with the poor. He was very concerned about and interested in mental illness, which was unusual in that time period. Not mental illness, but his concern for it. Then there's Abner Kneeland. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Abner Kneeland, but he was, we can call him a defrocked pantheist. He was a champion of civil liberties. He's at least a century ahead of his time. He was born into a Baptist family. Now, many of you know this, I hope, that the Universalists in our country, and you can trace Universalism back to way back to the beginning of the modern era, back to Jesus's time. But the Universalists in this country, many of them came out of the Baptist tradition. Kneeland was born into a Baptist family, became an itinerant Baptist preacher when he was in his early 20s, but then he discovered the writings of a man named Elhanan Winchester, who was also a former Baptist who had become a Universalist. Then Kneeland met Hosea Ballou, whom I've already mentioned, famous Universalist, and Ballou was his mentor. Well, by the time he was in his mid-30s, Kneeland had lost two wives and was having a crisis of faith, particularly about the authority of the Bible and even about the existence of the biblical God. Now, we have to always remember when we're talking about the 1800s and even into the 1900s, how important this was to many, many people, the authority of Scripture and how it was to be interpreted. Well, the problem was that out of this despair that Abner Kneeland was feeling and facing, he came out of that. He came out of that and got a big Universalist congregation in Philadelphia, a third wife, and he started working at a manic pace for religious and social change. He once debated in public a Presbyterian minister for 4 days, which was, they didn't have TV and they didn't have computers, and so debates were a common form of entertainment. But the subject of that debate, whether Universalist theology is biblically based. I don't know how long any of us would have lasted, not for 4 days. The problem was that challenging the authority of the Bible at this time risked being called an infidel. You could debate the interpretation if you were Universalist or Unitarian, but you could not debate the inspiration of Scripture. It was God-given, period. Kneeland left Philadelphia for a congregation in New York City, and while there, he invited a woman named Fanny Wright to speak. Fanny Wright was co-founder of an interracial commune in Neshoba, Tennessee. And when she spoke, all hell broke loose, so to speak, even though the Universalists supposedly didn't believe in hell. This was 1825. Kneeland was suspended from ministerial fellowship. He went to Boston, where he started the Society of Free Inquirers. 2,000 people came to these lectures of his. He sometimes openly scoffed at the Bible, and they held dances on Wednesday evenings, so he was in trouble. He wrote a creed in which he proclaimed, "I am not an atheist, capital A, but a pantheist, capital P. That is, instead of believing there is no God, I believe that in the abstract, all is God. Well, he was indicted for the crime of blasphemy. His real crime was probably that he challenged the social hierarchy. He supported equal rights for women and equality of the races. He suggested that women keep their own names and bank accounts. He supported out loud and in public birth control, divorce, and interracial marriage. Remember when he lived, the time frame. He's doing this in the 1830s. The prosecutor at his first trial for blasphemy was a Unitarian. So was the judge. So was the defense attorney. Neyland was convicted. He appealed. There were two more trials. Each resulted in hung juries. After a fourth trial, where the judge of the Supreme Judicial Court was yet another Unitarian, Neyland was sentenced to 60 days in jail for being a blasphemer. I don't want to neglect the women. This would be a good time to mention Lydia Ann Moulton Jenkins. Women in those days often had four names. She was really the first woman to be ordained by an organized church. You thought it was Olympia Brown, didn't you? No, Olympia Brown was the second one. We don't hear much about or even know a lot about Lydia Jenkins. We do know that she was co-minister with her husband in Clinton, New York, in a Universalist church. So she was actually ordained by the Ontario Association of Universalists in 1858, a few years before Olympia Brown. But she, there's a lot of speculation that she kind of slipped in there as being ordained, partly because nobody paid any attention to the Ontario Association. This is Ontario, New York, of a Universalist. And partly because she was co-ministering with her husband. So I think they kind of let her slip in there. And I'm not going to skip most of the rest of this. And I'm going to do a second sermon on it at some point in time. But I do want to honor our Universalist heritage. But there are just so many fascinating Universalists in this time period. You may have heard of P.T. Barnum, who did not say, there's a sucker born every whatever. Apparently he was way too nice and too kind and much too much of a true Universalist to have said that. You may also recognize the name Horace Greeley, who did say, though he probably heard it from somebody else, go west, young man, go west, and grow up with the country. I suspect you might think that you never heard of the seven Washburn brothers, but you might have heard of one of them. The seven Washburn brothers lived in the 1800s. Almost all seven of them were in politics from the middle of the 1800s on. The fourth brother in those seven brothers, his name was Cadwallader Washburn. Perhaps his parents were running out of names, I don't know. Cadwallader represented Wisconsin for three terms in Congress, was a major general at Vicksburg, and then he was governor of Wisconsin, Governor Washburn, except I think it's more fun to remember his first name. In his spare time, he was a businessman who, among other things, founded the Gold Medal Flour Company, General Mills, as we know it. The youngest of those seven brothers, William, founded Universalism in Minneapolis, and he was both a congressman and a U.S. senator from our neighboring state of Minnesota. Frances Dana Barker Gage helped get one of the first women's rights bills passed. That happened to be in Ohio. This woman, she lived from 1808 to 1884. She went to the Sea Islands of South Carolina. I didn't know there was any such thing. In 1863 to train freed slaves. The things they don't teach you in high school or even in college. And while there, she met someone named Clara Barton. The Universalists did not have another member of the clergy arrested for blasphemy, as Abner Neyland had been. However, Herman Bisbee was accused of heresy in 1870-something, tried by the Minnesota State Convention of Universalists, found guilty, and then removed from the Universalist ministry, even though his congregation in St. Anthony, Minnesota supported him and his preaching. His crime? He was one of the few Universalist Transcendentalists. He did return to ministry, but this time as a Unitarian. A little safer there, I guess. As I said, I'm going to skip most of this. I'm a little distracted because of Rosemary's comment, about not doing anything about Martin Luther King. And so in the back of my mind, I've been debating this. I haven't been debating that. I've been debating whether to say anything further at this moment. I can't speak for the entire program committee, but my recollection of a conversation, I sit on the program committee. The program committee, by the way, does a fantastic job. Is Penny not here? Penny Eiler, as chair, is, we should probably be paying her. She does so much. We talked about, of course, what we would do this Sunday. And then, as the schedule was falling together in different ways, and as I had realized that I had said I would do a follow-up on the cloud of witnesses, the people who have influenced us, and emphasize the Universalists, We remember, duh, that February is Black History Month. Now, we don't give much time to that in our congregations, I don't think. We concentrate on the weekend of Martin Luther King's birthday. And that's fine. That's good. But we decided that we would have our Black service, and I am extremely embarrassed to say this. And say it this way, but this is how it's coming into my head. Because think about this. We do one service a year for Martin Luther King. I'm sorry, Rosemary, but that doesn't cut it. And people are so used to, well, of course we're going to do something that weekend, that we thought we'd upset it a bit and do a service in February. So February 14th happens to be the date that we are doing a little more on Black history. But I don't know how to deal with that. And I'm just sorry that some of you may have come here today expecting something about Martin Luther King Jr. And I would never, ever want to slight Martin Luther King Jr. or anybody. I did think about repeating the service that I did last year. Did you notice where Martin Luther King said that quote that's at the top of your order of service? He said it at the Ware Lecture, which is a big part of General Assembly, our Unitarian Universalist Association General Assembly. And very recently, someone found in the archives a little book about other things King said, other quotes. King once said that, except for that rather huge part about accepting Jesus as your Savior, he was a Unitarian. Yeah. So we certainly had a spiritual connection to King, I think, and still do, I hope. Anyway, that's enough of all that. We have Soup Sunday to do. We have something to talk about, the issues and the action. This is a tough subject. This is hard. Mostly I just want to cry at the moment because this is hard. We're so goddamn lily white. And we don't know how to be otherwise. I urge you to go to the workshop, yes, more words, at James Reeb in March. Where maybe this came out of the shooting of Tony Robinson. Not the particular subject matter not the program, Who Are Your Neighbors, was already in place long before Tony Robinson was shot, but this came, having it here came out of that when the UU ministers met. As I was putting this together, I found I was going more in the direction of stories about Universalists because I'd already done that with the Unitarians. So I decided, you know, it's never enough time not to give any history. But you're absolutely right. That was, because, and as I said, many Universalists came out of the Baptist tradition, where they just couldn't believe that a loving God would ever condemn anyone to everlasting hellfire and damnation. Hence, we would all be saved. And again, it's so cultural. I don't think we can quite grasp how important that was to people in the 1700s and 1800s and other times too. So, and they were eventually a victim of their own success, the Universalists, capital U, because other people in other denominations started thinking, oh, that makes so much more sense, you know, that we will all be saved because God is a loving God. And so within the Baptist tradition and within the Methodist and Presbyterian and Episcopal and so on, they started saying, yes, we'll all be saved, with one caveat. They were talking about you would all be saved within that denomination after reciting certain creeds. So, yes, good point. Thank you. In a follow-up, you know, service, we'll talk about what happened to all those most of those little churches. And, of course, the Unitarians had good news, too, but heaven forbid that they should tell anybody about it. it's that same thing we have now, right? States make laws that legalizing marijuana. There's all sorts of fallout about, you know, the money you make from selling your marijuana, you can't put it in a federal bank because it's a federal offense. So it doesn't surprise me that he was tried, even convicted. What surprised me was that eventually he did go to prison for 60 days, and there were, you know, so I don't know, I'd have to look into that. That's a good question. The closing words are actually found in the back of the hymnal, number 704. You might want to look at those while I read a slightly different version. This original version by John Murray, the one in the back of the hymnal, was written in the late 1700s. This expanded version was written by a Unitarian minister in 1950. Go out into the highways and byways of America, your new country. Give the people, blanketed with a decaying and crumbling Calvinism, something of your new vision. You may possess only a small light, but uncover it, let it shine. Use it in order to bring more light and understanding to the hearts and minds of men and women isn't in either version. This one, the 704 in the back's been amended. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Do not push them deeper into their theological despair, but preach the kindness and everlasting love of God. Go in peace, eat soup, get coffee, greet your neighbor.